This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
Angola's new president has made some bold moves by removing two high-profile members of his predecessor's family from key economic positions. President José Lourenço also wants an investigation into the handling of the nation's oil resources, which were managed by the former president's daughter.
That's Anita Powell reporting from Johannesburg. Details coming up.
Also, protesters marched in Nairobi today following accusations that staff at one of the city's largest hospitals have tried to sexually assault new mothers. And Angola's new president wants an investigation into the handling of the nation's oil resources, which were managed by the former president's daughter.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, protesters marched in Nairobi today following accusations that staff at one of the city's largest hospitals have tried to sexually assault new mothers. The hospital denied the claims but has joined the health ministry in calling for a criminal investigation. Rael Ambor has the story for VOA from Nairobi.
It was a Facebook post gone viral that led to this march demanding better security and better maternal care at Kenyatta National Hospital in Nairobi. The administrator of a popular Facebook group known as Buyer Beware posted the story of a new mother who said she was nearly raped in the corridors of the hospital while going to breastfeed her baby. Other group members chimed in, alleging similar experiences and other misconduct by hospital staff. Later that same day, the Ministry of Health ordered police to investigate. On Tuesday, hundreds of protesters marched to the Ministry of Health to present a petition and then on to the hospital itself. There, outside the main gate, the marchers traded insults with hospital staff. Police acted as a buffer. Hospital staff held placards, some which read, "We are not rapists, we are professionals," while protesters held signs calling the hospital a vulgar name. The hospital head, Lily Koros, responded to the allegations.
"We wish to state that there is no mother or patient that has reported to have been raped or an attempted rape at Kenyatta National Hospital. Kenyatta National Hospital has 24-hour CCTV surveillance in the lifts and along the corridors to all the wards, including the newborn unit. Besides, there is security team, including uniformed officers, who oversee the safety and security of patients in the hospital during the day and night."
But the social media posts have struck a nerve in Kenya. Edna Okirosi took the day off work to participate in the protest.
"You know, rape is stigma in itself. Even in our homes, even in our homes in Arua, even in our estates, somebody, when somebody is raped, it is so hard for somebody even to go out, because at the end of the day when you go to report, it's like you're being raped again because you're reliving the experience."
Kenyatta National Hospital is the city's main public referral hospital. Other allegations facing the hospital administrations are rampant petty theft in the facility, slow service delivery, and overcrowding in the wards. Health Cabinet Secretary Cleopa Mailu has pledged to take action based on those findings. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
The aid organization CARE International reports North Korea and Eritrea top the list of the 10 most underreported, forgotten humanitarian crises of 2017. The other countries include Burundi, Sudan, Central African Republic, Democratic Republic of Congo, Mali, Lake Chad Basin, Vietnam, and Peru. Lisa Schlein reports from the launch of the report in Geneva.
The report shines a light on tens of millions of people who are forced to suffer in silence because their plight goes underreported and their needs go unmet. Last year, it estimates 220 million people in 37 countries were affected by the biggest humanitarian disasters in years. CARE International's Interim Secretary General, Laurie Lee, says the plight of 70 million of these people in the 10 least reported countries of emergency has been virtually ignored.
These 10 crises affect about a third of that 220 million people in need of humanitarian assistance in 2017, yet those emergencies received just 2% of the coverage. All but three of the bottom 10 reported major emergencies around the world in 2017 are in Africa. Africa is disproportionately represented on this list of 10.
UN High Commissioner for Refugees Filippo Grandi says humanitarian crises are not confined to a specific country of emergency. He tells VOA ignoring them carries many risks because they can have global consequences. He cites the case of Democratic Republic of Congo, which he calls one of the most worrisome crises.
But then let's not forget that some of the neighboring countries are in a difficult situation. South Sudan borders Congo, Burundi borders Congo. So what sometimes these crises do is they latch on to each other, become regional, destabilizing, and they're much more difficult to resolve at that particular stage.
CARE International warns 2018 is shaping up to be another grim year for millions of people beset by conflict and natural disasters. It says increased media attention can help focus public support on humanitarian crises which operate in the shadows and are largely ignored. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Angola's new president has made some bold moves by removing two high-profile members of his predecessor's family from key economic positions. President José Lourenço also wants an investigation into the handling of the nation's oil resources, which were managed by the former president's daughter. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Since taking office 4 months ago, Angolan President José Lourenço has made some attention-grabbing moves he says are part of his promise to fix the nation's ailing, corruption-riddled economy. In December, Isabel dos Santos was removed as head of the nation's oil company. And this month, José Filomeno dos Santos was ousted as chief of the nation's $5 billion sovereign wealth fund. Their father, José Eduardo dos Santos, stepped down last year after 38 years in power. By firing the dos Santos siblings, Chatham House analyst Alex Vines says Lourenço has earned a new nickname.
They've been removed out of their positions much more quickly than anybody would have imagined. Hence the nickname for Joao Lourenço in Angola now, which is the Terminator.
Analyst Paula Roque says she is reluctant to give the new president too much credit as a reformer.
You can't run a country, you certainly can't reform an economy without taking the levers of control of the revenues. And the oil company was certainly one of them. The sovereign wealth fund was created for rainy days, and Angola is certainly going through a crisis. So he really didn't have much of an option but to do what he did.
But she says this is far from a clean sweep. Anti-corruption watchdogs estimate the dos Santos family still controls billions of dollars worth of government resources.
In reality, Isabel still dominates the diamond sector of Angola. So it goes much deeper than just having key positions that we know of. We're talking about holding companies, shell companies. We're talking about the use of state resources to invest in private enterprises.
Economists have lauded the government's recent moves, like last week's announcement that Angola would repay its $5 billion debt by 2019. But Lourenço has also drawn fire from the anti-corruption activists for defending the nation's former vice president, who stands accused of bribing a Portuguese magistrate when he served as head of Angola's state oil company. Manuel Vicente's corruption trial began this week in Lisbon because Portugal has refused to transfer the case to Angola, saying they do not believe Vicente would be properly investigated if he comes back home. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Hugh Masekela, the trumpeter, composer, and anti-apartheid activist known as the father of Southern African jazz, has died at the age of 78 in Johannesburg. His family today said Masekela, affectionately called Brahiu, passed away after a protracted and courageous battle with prostate cancer. Masekela's career began in the 1950s when he helped create the Johannesburg jazz scene. He fled South Africa in the 1960s to spend the next three decades in exile. He befriended American singer and activist Harry Belafonte, and he increasingly used his music to protest the repression of white minority rule in his homeland. Among his better-known protest tunes were Soweto Blues and Bring Him Back Home, an anthem demanding the release of anti-apartheid icon Nelson Mandela from prison. Masekela scored an international number one hit in 1968 with Grazing in the Grass. He later collaborated with American pop star Paul Simon in the 1980s. He was briefly married in the 1960s to Miriam Makeba, the legendary South African singer and activist. South African President Jacob Zuma praised Masekela today, saying he kept the torch of freedom alive through his music.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehis Wuhib, 16 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Protesters marched in Nairobi today following accusations that staff at one of the city's largest hospitals have tried to sexually assault new mothers. CARE International reports North Korea and Eritrea topped the list of the 10 most underreported, forgotten humanitarian crises of 2017. And Angola's new president wants an investigation into the handling of the nation's oil resources, which were managed by the former president's daughter. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
Street vendors and public transport operators who operate illegally in Zimbabwe vow they will not obey a government ultimatum to move or be shut down. The Harare mayor and the minister of local government issued the ultimatum last week, reporter Kuzayi Zvinavashi reports.
The minister of local government and public works, Julai Moyo, and Harare mayor Bernard Manyenyeni last Friday warned vendors and illegal public transport operators that they had 48 hours to vacate the streets. Samuel Wazai is the director for Vendors Initiative for Social and Economic Transformation, known as VSET. He says vendors will not go anyway.
It is our position that ultimatums and threats of force will only worsen the already precarious situation. Our message that must be communicated loud and clear is that we are not going to leave the streets.
The original 48 hours has passed with no government action. Still, Wazai says government's order is a direct attack on livelihoods. Wazai says his group will engage with relevant authorities on the issue, as dialogue is the best way forward. But he says vendors are prepared to go to court. VSET is a member of the Citizen Manifesto, a collective movement that houses various organizations and individuals. Briggs Bomba is with Citizen Manifesto. He says the government is being heavy-handed.
They have decided to take an approach of looking at every problem as a nail. So the first thing that you do is you go for a hammer. That's the approach that they're taking, and that does not work. What we would propose to the city council as well as the administration is to move with the times and you co-create solutions.
Bomba says this would require everyone affected by the issue into talk. Michael Chideme is the Harare City Council spokesperson. He says council has always encouraged dialogue in finding long-standing solutions.
Engagement has always been the hallmark of how we operate as a local authority. But it's quite unfortunate that some of the associations are now talking of engagement because there is a new scenario on the ground. We are always engaging even the individual vendors who really want the space, who are not into activism.
Chideme says such vendors have always fallen prey to extortionists who demand daily payments from vendors. The standoff comes as the country is on high alert because of a cholera outbreak. The Minister of Health and Childcare says vendors were partly to blame for such outbreaks. Viset and Citizen Manifesto say that claim is political grandstanding. In the meantime, vendors and illegal public transport operators remain in Harare, waiting to see if the government acts on its ultimatum. For VOA, this is Kudzai Znawashe from Harare.
In Malawi, non-governmental organizations are protesting the sharp rise in the annual fee they must pay. The government says the increase is needed to meet financial needs of its NGO oversight board. Any organization that fails to pay the fees within 3 months will have their operations suspended. But groups are refusing to comply, saying the increase is unreasonable. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Until January 1, the NGOs were required to pay an annual fee of 50,000 kwacha, or $35, but the new regulation requires them to pay 1 million kwacha, or about $1,400. Abigail Zimaz is the chairperson for the NGO board and says the increase is necessary.
In order for us to meet our budget for regulating all the NGOs in this country, in fact, it should make us more efficient.
Most government agencies in Malawi are low on funds after many donor nations suspended support to Malawi in 2013 because of a corruption scandal in which over $32 million was looted from government coffers. As a result, many donors opted to channel their assistance to the country through private non-profit organizations. 30 non-profits known as the Rights Defenders Forum say in a joint statement that the new fee is meant to kill their operations. Charles Kajoloweka is the director for the organization Youth and Society.
The increment is basically ridiculous. We are a non-profit sector, therefore we are going to struggle to raise such fees. And at the end of the day, government can decide to shut down such NGOs, which would be quite unfortunate.
Kajoloweka says the government has long tried to silence organizations it deems too critical of government policies.
For example, recently we saw some human rights activists being arrested simply for the reason of organizing demonstrations. Billy Mayaya would be an example. Threats have been issued against some NGO leaders. I personally got death threats when we are pushing the Maizegate case.
Maizegate was a corruption scandal last year involving the purchase of maize from Zambia. Zimadzi says she cannot comment further on the issue at the moment.
It's a contentious issue, and government is calling for a meeting for us, all parties, whether it's Thursday, Friday. So for me to keep on, you know, justifying, it would be a bit inappropriate.
In the meantime, leaders of the Council for Non-Governmental Organization in Malawi have asked members not to pay the increased fees until they discuss the matter with the government. Last year, NGOs in Malawi were under pressure from government to comply with a 2001 law, which, among other things, requires them to submit their annual reports to the government. But statistics from the NGO board show that only 19% of the NGOs have so far submitted their last year's reports. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
The World Health Organization's Director General is calling on its 192 member states to adopt universal health care as the best way of guaranteeing health for all. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva, where its week-long executive board meeting is underway.
This is the first time Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus has addressed the 34-member executive board since assuming his post in July as the first African head of the World Health Organization. And the former Ethiopian health minister was not shy about touting his accomplishments during his first 6 months in office. He set a plan to transform the WHO into a stronger, more relevant organization has been developed. Tedros proudly noted he had achieved gender parity in the WHO's top ranks, with women outnumbering men. Tedros said the WHO has built strong political momentum on non-communicable diseases and tuberculosis, and that a new initiative to combat the health effects of climate change in small island developing states has been launched. He appeared most enthusiastic about his vision to achieve health for all.
At least half of the world's population still lacks access to essential health services, and almost 100 million people are pushed into extreme poverty every year because of out-of-pocket health spending. This must end.
Tedros said recent visits to Kenya, Madagascar, and Rwanda convinced him that universal health coverage is not a pipe dream. He said all three countries are creating affordable health care systems.
I'm more convinced than ever that UHC is not only the best investment in a healthier world, it's also the best investment in a safer world. As you have heard me say, universal health coverage and health security are two sides of the same coin.
The WHO chief said he hoped to advance this issue at the World Health Assembly in May. He said he would ask as many countries as possible to make commitments at the WHA regarding the action they will take toward achieving universal health coverage at home. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Australia has filed a formal complaint with the World Trade Organization that accuses Canada of placing discriminatory rules on the sales of imported wine. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Canada is Australia's fourth biggest wine market. Officials in Canberra say rules in Canada unfairly discriminate against overseas wine. An official protest has been lodged with the World Trade Organization against regulations in the Canadian province of British Columbia, where wine produced locally can be sold in grocery stores, but imports must be sold in a store within a store with a separate cash register. Canberra's objection also targets policies in other provinces, including Ontario, Quebec and Nova Scotia, as well as federal practices in Canada, which could breach a WTO agreement. They mean higher prices for foreign wines, as well as other barriers to sale, according to the Australian complaint. Australian Trade Minister is Steve Chobo.
Australia is seeing its market share in that market erode. That concerns me, it concerns wine exporters. Potentially this could cost Australian jobs. So I want to make sure that we're on the front foot about protecting Australia's interests.
Australia's complaint to the WTO is similar to the one made by the United States, which has accused Canada of placing unfair limits on the sale of imported wine. In October, the US said British Columbia was favouring local vineyards by giving their wine an exclusive retail outlet in grocery store shelves and cutting out US competition. A spokesman for Canada's international trade minister said the federal government works to ensure its liquor policies are consistent with our international trade commitments. Under WTO rules, Canada has 60 days to settle the dispute with Australia. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Linor Mudu. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.